Welcome to episode 10 of The Iron Agenda, the podcast about War Machine, Hordes, and whatever else is on our minds.
Hey everybody, and welcome to The Iron Agenda, the self-proclaimed unofficial official podcast of War Machine Weekend. I'm Josh.
I'm Dave.
And I'm Pat.
And with us today, we have the father of War Machine Weekend, Carl Morgan.
Illegitimate father.
Yeah, there you go.
Hot Carl. The baby daddy.
War Machine Weekend's baby daddy, Carl Morgan.
We're here in the green room in the back of Metagames Unlimited in Springfield, Missouri.
Yeah, speaking of the green room, Pat, I seem to recall last week you mentioned something that it won't be cold in Springfield, right?
Well, it's really not that cold. It's just the fact that half of us are, like, sick. So it's, like, colder. And we are in the meat locker green room here.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's normal fall weather.
Sure it is.
Hey, I'm in shorts.
That's your mistake.
Oh, well. You just wanted to see my sexy legs.
We're already sick, Pat. I don't want to get even more.
So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, since we're down here, this would probably be a good opportunity to actually talk about War Machine Weekend. So, Carl.
Yes.
War Machine Weekend.
What do you want to know?
Well, I'd like to know, how did this come about, the first one? This is the third this year, is that correct?
The fifth.
I can't count.
It's been around for a few years now, and we're still working out the kinks.
Well, from what I've seen, it looks to be run very smoothly so far.
I appreciate that.
I mean, especially because you got a big group of people, and in the events that I've seen in the past, when you get that many people, it can be pretty hectic. And I for one, can say that it looks like it's gone pretty smoothly.
We had a 40-man tournament first thing yesterday.
Yeah, like I have told many people when apologizing for things running late, we ran a 11 a.m. tournament on a Friday morning and this isn't like Gen Con or anything where people take a week off to come do. It's a weekend event. Last year we had some people hanging out starting at 10 for a 3 a.m. or a 3 p.m. event. We thought, well, if people are going to be hanging out this year, we might as well have something for them to do. So we're like, okay, we'll do 11 a.m. event for the handful of people that are here, thinking that we may get 10 to 20 people. And we had 40 people on Friday morning.
Wow.
So next year, it's going to start on Thursday.
And
you're going to have the 40 people on Thursday. Yeah. That's what happens.
It'll probably still start on Friday. 3 days is about all I can handle. I'm getting a little old.
maybe not all of us, but I hear you. The old man of the podcast.
Not like the early. I mean, last night we ended about 4 a.m. It's not like the first year or two. It was like getting over at 4 or 5 on Friday and Saturday morning. And it drug on a little bit. So last year we actually did really good, but this year it lasts a little longer, but we're gonna fix that and make sure that everybody has a good time and events.
Well, tonight you don't have like a long event running tonight. I think you've got the IK role playing session tonight. So that hopefully will help the fact that you're not running a tournament late.
The last events are the IK session, and then at 8 o'clock we're actually doing a 350-point Mangle Metal / Tooth and Claw hardcore tournament with 3-minute turn. So it should go relatively quick. Nice little wrap up fun event for the day after, the 1,000-point event or the 500-points event, depending on what you play in.
What kind of attendance do you usually have?
Last year we had a little over, like right around 80 people. And that's 80 unique people. Like since we run events at multiple times, like that's going on today, we would have 20 to 30 to 40 in each event. And some of them will run simultaneous. And you'll have some people that play on Friday that won't play on Saturday and vice versa. So we had 80 unique players last year throughout all the events. And this year, I know pre-register, we had more than we had last year. I haven't checked the final numbers, but we'll probably at least equal that this year.
Cool.
Well, I'd like to know what brought about War Machine Weekend. What was the impetus for its creation?
Actually, when we first had the idea, and I was on the press gang forums. I've been press ganging since day one. I've been involved with War Machine for as long as most people have. Not everybody, but for a long time. I was on the press gang forums, on the privateer forums, and saying, it'd be fun because I run events all the time. Be fun to sort of get the press gangers together and run an event for just the press gangers, just a fun, get together, drink beer, play a bunch of games. And we started to organize it, saying, okay, we'll try to do it, one weekend. And then it became, hey, is it all right if I invite some friends? Can I invite some friends? And so we just said, all right, I'm just going to turn it into a weekend event. And as far as I know, it was the first, it's the first and longest running Privateer Press only event in the country.
Cool.
We've been running, like I said, this is our fifth year. First year, I think we had, you know, in 2004, we had 30 to 35, 40 people for that. And it's just grown every year. So it's a lot of fun.
So now you mentioned the press gangers. How many press gangers do you have in the down here in Southwest Missouri?
Me.
Oh, okay. It's just you? Okay.
There, we had another one here in town. He just recently moved to St. Louis and isn't press ganging anymore. Him and his wife, you know, relocated, got a new job, whatnot. So I think,
Sam?
Yeah, Sam okay. Hazel. He, great guy. He still helps out. He's helping me run the event today. Mm-hmm. But he's not active like he used to be. For the first 3 years, I ran it by myself. Then he came in last year, helped me run it, which was a huge help. And then he came back to help me run it this year.
Yeah, I actually gave him a couple of Game St. Louis business cards. Hopefully he'll come out and game with us once in a while.
I'm sure we'll see him. Sounds like it. Now, you're obviously associated with metagames here. How did that come about?
Back in the day, I was teaching high school. I was teaching high school and working as a librarian full-time. And I got a part-time job about the same time I became a press ganger, part-time job here to help out at the store. And it just sort of morphed, and now I'm working here full-time and quit the teaching job and the librarian job. So a lot less stressful. It was a lot of jobs, but my stress level has decreased quite a bit in my life now. So that's good.
I bet the game store is a little bit more fun than the kids.
Dewey Decimal System, man. That's where it's at.
You would be amazed how much of a similarity teaching art in high school to freshmen and running a game store is at times.
How funny.
I'll buy that.
Where do you teach?
Oh, I was teaching just north of Springfield here in a small town called Bolivar.
Okay. I'm from Springfield originally. That's why I was asking. So, well, speaking of the store, and like I just mentioned, I'm from here. So I moved up to St. Louis in about 1996, I think it was. So for me, growing up in Springfield, I did not have this wonderful store here. And it was kind of a sparse, I would say, you know, the gaming scene here in Springfield up until then. So
back in the day, you had the Comic Page and Hobby Dashery.
Yeah.
And then Boneheads.
Caveman was, that was more comics. Was it pretty exclusively?
I was working at Caveman for a long time.
Were you really?
Back in the day. But I was doing like a lot of their music and stuff like that as opposed to other stuff. That's where I got my start in like the whole collectible thing. I actually worked in music stores, did a lot of records and vinyl stuff.
Yeah. So I know for me, my first time in the store was a couple of years ago, I guess, because I actually had talked to a common friend of ours, Phil, and he told me about metagames. And I'm like, I think I'd heard of that when it was in the other location, in the smaller location. He goes, oh, no, they've got a new location. It's a big store. You got to go over there and see it. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, thinking, yeah, it's, you know, Springfield gaming scene. And then I came into the store. I'm like, oh, my gosh, what a fantastic store. And I'm so happy that Springfield's got such a wonderful store of this size now. And it looks like, you know, from the times I've been here, there's always a lot of people in here. And wow, that's just fantastic. You know, the hometown has got such a good store now.
Well, we appreciate it. It's sort of a mecca around the area. I've explained this to a couple people. It's sort of a anomaly. And I mean, there's no other way to put it. Because we have a store that's bigger than you will find in a lot of major cities. One of the guys that came in for the tournament's from Atlanta, and he says there's nothing like this in Atlanta. You might have to go to Chicago, LA. I mean, I think Dragon's Lair in Austin is another big one, but there's not too many places that are this size. And it's the size and everything is part of it, but I mean, there's nothing in the area for people to do, really. Springfield isn't a hotbed of a, you know, nightlife or social scenes or anything
this
like that.
True.
So, and we have a lot of feeder communities. So it's sort of a perfect storm of all these different things that come together to make an interesting gaming location. And we're also able to bring in a lot of different audiences because we have anywhere from, you know, like our War Machine players and our miniature players to Magic to role players. And we've gotten everybody sort of peacefully coexist.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing we're here for the War Machine side of things. But, you know, like we mentioned before, the guys from Bear Swarms podcast from this very room.
There you go.
Usually on Sundays, is that right?
Yeah, they're here every Sunday. Usually playing on Friday nights and recording on Sunday.
There's nothing this big in St. Louis either. I mean,
well, we were just talking
close.
Fantasy Shop is, but it's different. I mean, they probably have about the same space or so, but it's not as well used.
there's also three stores kind of, well, or more, four, I guess, competing in St. Louis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, here, I'm assuming there's not much other competition.
There's two other stores here in town.
Really?
But, yeah, they, like, one of them I know is primarily focused on role-playing games and comics, and the other one primarily focuses on Magic.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's not too many that try to do everything.
When you get into a situation like this, it seems like, it seems logical to me that you'd have a store that does cater to all tastes. I mean, that's just only going to help your chances of success.
You would think, but there's a lot of store owners out there, and there's people that have their own, you know, views on, and I'm not going to tell people that they're running their business wrong or doing things right or wrong, but their business model, or sometimes they don't even have a business model when they open a game store, more or less it's a glorified clubhouse for when it starts. And so if I am opening a store and I'm big into Magic, I may focus on card games.
Sure.
And that's just sort of how some stores start. And to be honest, this store started with a couple guys who were big into Magic, and they got into, you know, one of the guys gets into miniatures, and it sort of snowballed from there. But they realized early on, the owners had a pretty good foresight to realize that they're not going to keep growing without the different communities, and they've done a pretty good job pulling everything together.
This is the first War Machine Weekend I've ever been to, and one thing that I noticed about it was you seem to have a lot of unique things that you won't find necessarily at other conventions or weekend things. Like, the big thing that I noticed was the new trophies you had out front. You had the print that Explosivo made. It's a very nice piece of artwork that goes to, I guess, the pre-reg people.
Yes.
And can you talk about the cool, unique things that
last year, I started working with he's one of the players. He's been here for a few years. He comes in from Kansas City. His name's Chris Johnson. Really good artist, and he came the second or third year we had it. When he came in, he made a very big impact on everybody. And if you went to Gen Con last year and played at any of the tournaments, you probably heard him yell out Explosivo across the crowd.
I did hear that, yeah.
But he's a very infectious player. He's a great guy, super fun to play against. And that first year he came in, he just exemplified everything that we look for in players, and especially like War Machine Weekend. I don't run War Machine Weekend to be the end-all sale of competitive tournaments. I try to get the casual players to play with the hardcore tournament players. I want that mix of the crowd. So, you know, sort of a miniature convention for everybody, not just the people who want to go to Gen Con and win nationals.
That's good, because it's really easy for some of us who play a lot of tournaments to get burnt out on the over-competitiveness.
Absolutely.
Too quickly. And, you know, I'm actually glad. I put together a couple lists for the event that's going to run here in an hour or so, and it's nothing overly competitive. I'm going to take some stuff I don't usually take and have some fun.
Yeah, that's what we really push. Have fun. Enjoy yourself. Get away for the weekend. I still want that same feeling when I came up with the idea for War Machine Weekend. I want it to be a fun getaway for everybody. I don't want it to be a stressful, oh my God, how am I going to, you know, win this tournament and that tournament? Just come in and have fun.
I took a lesson from Gen Con. I was playing all the big PP tournaments there, and I was bored out. I was sick of it. And so I came here expecting to do the same thing, to play all these tournaments, and I realized, like Dave was doing, you know, just hanging out, playing pickup games maybe, or just talking to people, that's half the experience right
there. It's halfway through Saturday, and I actually haven't played a event game yet. I've just been, you know, talking to some people and hanging out. I guess we need to start doing some interviews too.
But you know, you could do it both ways. It's there if you do want to play a
couple
games.
Yeah, because I know,
make of it what you want.
For me, I played in the 350 No Jacks Allowed event yesterday and had a lot of fun, but I haven't played anything else. I was going to play the 500 War Machine this morning, but I woke up sick, so I'm like, I'm just going to sleep some more and try to get better. So
be amazed how many people sleep in on Saturday mornings, because they'll come in on Friday night and just run themselves ragged, and then Saturday mornings they come dragging in, and Sunday mornings they come dragging in. But
I mean, you guys get out of here at what, 3-something?
We got around in between 3:30 and 4 yesterday, this morning, and then tonight will be better. But you know, like on Saturday night last year, we got done about midnight. Everybody went and hit one of the local restaurants, and like all the War Machine players sort of flooded that. And it was, and that to me was the most fun of last year, was not just having the tournaments, you know, running that's great, but getting just to hang out with everybody. And you get to know, like I got to know guys from, you know, Oklahoma and Nebraska. I mean, the Midwest is really a neat place, because we've got awesome War Machine players, or, you know, War Machine Hordes players here. And I would put our surrounding states, Missouri and surrounding states, up against anybody in the country. I think this area has some of the best players out there, not just competitive, but fun to play against too.
How far away do people come to this?
Well, we've got a lot of people. We got a huge crowd from Nebraska. We're here in Southwest Missouri, so we've got a big crowd in Nebraska, a bunch from Oklahoma, Arkansas, you know, all the surrounding states, St. Louis, Kansas City. And we've actually got a guy that came in from Austin, and we had a guy flying from Atlanta.
Wow. That's
so
awesome.
Pretty cool. I was honored by, you know, somebody doing that. So that was really, really cool.
All right. Well, Carl, you mentioned, you know, we've mentioned here some of the events that were run this weekend, but obviously going over this now isn't going to help anybody who's not here. But as an idea for next year, like, why don't you run down real quick? What events did you run this weekend?
Okay.
Or are we running?
The basic schedule works out like this. Friday morning, we ran Mangle Metal Tooth and Claw, 350 points, pretty basic. That afternoon, I had some requests for, you know, different types of events. So we did a 350-point War Machine, no jack. So it's just troops, cast, or go. A quick, fun event. Then 750-point steamroller, pretty basic. Saturday is, again, you know, we've got the big, which is what I'm sort of trying to turn into the marquee event of the weekend, is the 1,000-point tournament. And this is like if you want to play in the big event, that's it. And then run concurrently with that is a 500-point War Machine and then a 500-point Hordes tournament. And then tonight will be the 350-point hardcore Mangle Metal Tooth and Claw. Really fast, fun. And also, last night and tonight, we're running the Iron Kingdoms role-playing event. That's the first time we've done that. And last night, it seemed to go over pretty good. And then tomorrow morning, we'll run another 750-point steamroller and a 500-point crossover steamroller. So, and that'll wrap it up. And then, oh, of course, this year, we threw in at the last second a constructed Monster Apocalypse tournament. So,
oh, it's actually constructed.
It's constructed because we are almost sold out of boosters and starters.
So wow.
We don't have any unit boosters to do a sealed event, or else we probably would have done that. But, you know, the Monster Apocalypse is free to anybody who wants to play, and it's basically bring in what, you know, whatever you've gotten over the last week or so, come in and play, have fun. That's it.
Awesome.
What time is that scheduled to start?
I think it's 3:00 tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
So you have quite a few steamroller tournaments going on. How do you think the Steamroller 4 rules have changed the game? Is it easier to run?
I like the steamroller events. And as I've said before, I think the only issue that I've had is not with the scenarios, it's not with anything except for the length of the rounds. I think the length of the rounds are a little long. As printed, they're a little long, probably too long in some cases. But I understand why they make some of the lengths they do, but I still think that's the only thing that I have an issue with. I think the scenarios and the way now they've got how victory points only count in certain control areas, I think that's great.
Well, VPs aren't even a liability anymore like
no.
they used to.
Yeah. No, in fact, you want VPs now. You want a concentration of VPs, so it's easier to get them in the...
Right.
So that's one of the ways I think they've fixed the jacks. Like
heading that direction.
Yeah,
at least,
it's getting there.
Yeah,
I think... This is kind of a tangent, but my favorite iteration of Steamroller 4 is the one that came out right before DICON. I'm not entirely thrilled with the concept of dice down, but I know that I it seems like I'm in the minority for that.
I think
so,
that's the case.
That's my only real complaint with Steamroller 4, but it's playable. It seems to work so far.
No, you in general, at least this is my understanding, you don't like timed turns too much. Do you mind that so much in the Steamroller 4?
Because
they are longer than hardcore.
I don't really like the idea of timed turns. They're long enough that it really doesn't have as big of an impact on me.
Unless you're me.
Well.
No, but I know what you mean. Sorry.
Philosophically, I'm not entirely thrilled with them, but I understand the need for them given the rest of the Steamroller format.
Sure.
The timed rounds... The way I look at it is they're not as bad as hardcore, and for me, it gives me a little nudge in the direction of trying to get to play faster, because as we all know, or anybody that knows me, I'm a slow player, and so I try to play fast, but I played in one Steamroller event. Oh, it was the Too Poor for Gen Con event, mm-hmm. and they used the timed rules, or the timing rules, and I did okay, but there were a couple times where, you know, you came to, the clock dinged, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I wasn't done with what I really wanted to try to do, and... It's a new kind of a thing for me. So
I think I think Carl and Josh will agree with me. Is if you play hardcore, playing Steamroller 4, the time turns seem like they're irrelevant.
Yes,
because I mean I moved 45 to 50 protector infantry troops in 7 minutes in hardcore. Mm-hmm. I think I can do that in 12 now without a problem.
Well, I usually play a Terminus list once in a while that has anywhere between 50 and 55 models in it, and I can usually get that done in 7 minutes.
You guys are,
I mean, things are running half the time, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Carl, I mean, you're running things a lot here. Do you ever not, or do you lament not being able to play too much during this event, during the weekend?
I got to play a couple years ago, and it was DC from St. Louis actually came and ran one of the events and let me play in it. That was pretty cool. My goal here is to make sure everything runs smooth and everybody else has a good time. I get to play, you know, off and on through the store, have a good time. I would like to play. I think I want to try to play more in the area. I'm not so much worried about playing here, but I want to try to make a concerted effort to get out to the surrounding communities, like get to St. Louis, play some more events there, go to Kansas City, play some there.
You guys be welcome to come up.
Absolutely, yeah.
I want to get out and do that more because I like everybody that is from the area, and I like my own group of players too, but getting out and playing new people, you know, like getting that fresh blood gives you a whole other perspective.
Yeah.
And it's a lot better for my taste to play a lot of other people a lot of time. So
I know the first time I played a lot of non-St. Louis people was at the tournament at Rolla. Was that a year or so ago? That was quite a while.
It was a little.
It was when Rise had just came out. Yeah. And you know, I've seen some of you guys again at DICON, mm-hmm. and then now here, and it's actually, and Gen Con too. You know, it's nice to see people that you recognize at these events, even if you don't get a chance to play against them, to just kind of, you know, hey, how's it going, and you know, talk a little shop and that kind of stuff. And I think it's a great opportunity to do that, among other things.
Right.
Okay, so we're down here for 3 days of gaming, but I'll bet it takes a lot longer than that to actually organize and set up everything.
No, I bet you it takes a day or two.
Oh, yeah? Yeah,
that's all.
Spare time, Carl?
About 12 hours. No. between the organizational part does take a while. First year I had it not in the store. Of course, that was when we had a different location and we couldn't even think about having the room for it. But even now, you have to make sure you've got tables, make sure you have terrain. Luckily, we've got all that in stock right now. I was worried yesterday that with 40 people showing up at 11 a.m. that if I got overran today, I was going to run out of tables, but I think we're doing fine. Make sure, like, the t-shirts are done. Make sure that everything's ordered, you know, the prize kits are in, that kind of stuff. And there's things that are going to fall through the cracks, and there's things that's going to get missed, and it's setting the ball in motion and then damage control.
How far in advance did you have to set the ball in motion?
I started working, like, the first War Machine week, and I started working about 4 months in advance. It was maybe 4 or 5 months in advance. Of course, back then, you know, I contacted, like, Allie McVeigh and got her to paint a miniature for us as a prize. I mean, that we did that the first 3 years. I think the first year she did a Sorsha, which is actually one of the Get Local guys won. It's on display here in the store. Second year, she did an awesome Piper Vord. And then third year.
I think a St. Louis guy has that.
Yeah, I think I've so. Seen it. And then the third year, she did a really cool Totem Hunter. And the Totem Hunter even had as a little side note, had a cool little piece of the Orgoth Temple that they did for Apotheosis. Apotheosis, I guess when they moved studios, it broke. So cool. She actually took a piece off that and used it as a base, which was just a neat little.
That's cool.
That's pretty cool.
Neat little sidebar.
How unique.
So I'd get in touch with her like well in advance, and that would take, you know, I made sure she had more than enough time. And then stuff like t-shirts and all the peripheral stuff, you know, make sure like a couple months out. So it's a lot of little things over a long period of time. And then as the weeks get closer, we get 2-3 weeks out, you know, you got to make sure that pre-registration is done. You got to make sure that, you know, everything is just ready to go. And then that way, the day before I go, you know, set up the tables, do the terrain. That way, when people start coming in, it's less work then, you know, have all your paperwork ready to go with, you know, registration sheets and, you know, scorecards and things like that. That way it's just boom and done. And then you have less work on the back end and can enjoy the event more.
Are you doing all this by yourself?
I did all the organization and prep by myself except for Chris Johnson, who helped. He took care of He designed the awards. He designed the T-shirt. He took over a lot of stuff this year and did some really cool. Last year, he did a poster for us that we gave out to the people who pre-registered. We got another one this year that he did. But he also did T-shirts. He did some banners that are hanging in the store. He did a little bit of everything, and he did some amazing awards that are really good, because every year we've had really, really bad luck. Anybody that came to the first War Machine Weekend will tell you the bad luck we had with our trophies and misspelled things on plaques, and it was just a comedy of errors when it came to trophies. And so this year we had somebody who knew what they were doing and did something sort of unique for us that we're pretty proud of.
Those little touches really add a lot of specialness to these sorts of things.
Yeah, I like those trophies. They're pretty nice looking.
They are very nice.
Yeah, those are cool. You mentioned it. Who actually put those trophies together?
He did. He and I don't have all the details. Him and his workshop of gnomes, I guess.
Yeah.
Got the pieces made, and he assembled and put it all together. He's a graphic designer, so he has contacts where to get stuff made, and he did it. He got it done. So
it's awesome.
Hats off to him.
And apparently, I learned this last night that apparently gnomes are now in the Monsters Manual. They're not in the Player's Handbook anymore. So,
oh, yeah.
As a side note,
he's going to have to switch to a Tiefling workshop since he's
exactly.
Places.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very cool.
He hasn't switched over to 4th Ed. I think he.
Oh, okay.
I think he denied that.
All right. He should be okay then.
All right, so we've kind of covered what you've done in the past and what you've done this year. Do you have any plans for the future, any new things you're going to bring up next year?
Well, we're probably, if it's still going, and I hope it does, because I think it's sort of fun, I hope, you know, maybe have a couple Monsterpocalypse events next year. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of it, we sort of try to bounce ideas off the players, you know, see what they want to do. We're still going to do the 1,000-point tournament. I'd like to really try to push to get something special, like a special prize for the winner of the 1,000-point tournament, because that's one of my goals is, you know, we've got hardcore tournaments all over the place. There's not too many people that do 1,000-point tournaments. You can't go to Gen Con and play in a 1,000-point tournament unless you are really good and make it to the last day of Masters.
Which is four people
right. out of a 100 some that don't get to play that format. So we wanted to have it available to whoever wants to play that. And I'd like the 1,000-point event to become. It's not a standard. It's not something you're going to play all the time. But for a big, you know, a big event, you know, I think it's good to have that option. It's a whole different dynamic than you'll play at 500 or 750. So. And I think it needs to be spotlighted a little more.
Now, you mentioned the 1,000-point tournament, and we've kind of talked about some of the awards you get out, give out at the end of the weekend. But one thing that you guys do, which is really cool, is that a random person, not necessarily the winner of every event, gets selected to basically pick an army that would qualify for that event, and you give them some army.
We'll build that army for them. What we do is, and this was one of the ideas I had, and when Ali McVeigh left Privateer, and it was a little harder to get a hold and say, hey, could you do a miniature for us? I think the 4th year she was actually in the middle of her pregnancy, and I was like, I'm not going to bug her with that.
You got a miniature of your own to deal with.
and so I was coming up with – we actually threw around some other ideas. One of the ideas that I actually had approved from the owner of Metagames and, you know, the people sponsoring the event is we were going to do a cash prize. We're going to do – big event, $500 cash prize, first place. And then I batted around, even talked to some of the people privateer. I this was brought to me as a idea, and I was like, that's interesting. I don't quite know what I think of that. So I remember talking to Dan and Kevin at Privateer about it, and they had, I think, the same idea I had, that it could just bring out the worst in players.
Yeah, the cash prize?
Yeah.
And so
we started moving away from that. And I've had enough of players arguing over nitpicky things for coins. I don't want, you know, fist fights brewing over, you know, a $500 check that they may or may not get.
And as a player, I don't want to see 40 epic flads.
We started kicking around some other ideas. It's like, okay, if we've got X amount of money to give out amongst the top 4 people, well, how can we disperse that amongst more people and give more people the opportunity to enjoy something like that? So we started crunching the numbers, and we were like, okay, let's give out an army for each thing. We lost our sort of premier prize with the painted miniature. So we said, okay, well, what we'll do is anybody who plays in an event, and not just plays, but plays and finishes, because the year before, the couple of years before, we had, you know, some pretty competitive people, and they got, and some of the locals were complaining they got burnt out because they didn't, you know, some of the more casual players just couldn't, didn't have a chance to play. I mean, when they played them, they were going to lose, period. So what they did, you know, they were complaining a little bit about it. So I said, all right, what can we do to fix this? And I said, well, let's give away this army. Let's give away the army, but to somebody who starts and finishes an event so they can't drop out in the middle of the event, get frustrated and drop and still win. I want to give the people who are the novices a reason to stick around and play against the competitive players. They'll learn, they would learn more by doing that and hopefully have fun, maybe learn that sometimes when you lose, you still learn quite a bit tactically. I mean, I remember a lot of the miniature games I played, and like for when I was playing 40K, when I first started playing, I didn't win a game for 3 months, but I learned more in that 3 months than I ever did the rest of the time I played.
Sure.
Because I stuck with it, and I was wanting some of the other players to realize that. So we gave those players a reason to keep playing, where at the end of each event, we do a random drawing, and it may be somebody who finishes in the top three, and maybe somebody who finishes dead last. In fact, the 350 point No Jack award went to a guy who has not, he didn't win a game in throughout the first day. I think almost to the end of the first day, he won his first game, and that was through three events. So I was sort of happy to see that he went away with a prize like that.
He's a nice guy too. He's one of the guys from Raleigh.
Sure, we've seen him a couple times. Nice guy,
and he's also a listener.
He's a veteran.
So, congratulations, Dave.
I know who you're talking about. I saw him yesterday. I recognize him.
Dave Edie.
Yep. Cool. That's good.
But yeah, we want to spread the wealth amongst everybody. And if that means, you know, putting together a 1,000-point army for a random person who, you know, plays and sticks it out, then they get a new 1,000-point army. And it's better than handing some guy a check for, you know, $100, $500 that, you know, I think the army to that person is going to mean more. And if it's a random person who doesn't play as much, but just maybe like we've got, I know for a fact that this weekend we've got a few people locally who I know haven't played more than five games who are playing this weekend and are sort of learning on the go. If one of those people wins an army, they're going to have more invested interest in staying in with the game, sure, and learning how to play, and maybe they'll enjoy it more in the long run. Mm-hmm. So it helps grow the community, I think, too. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with the first one's free mentality.
There you go. Get them out.
Yeah. And I think it's really cool. I mean, it was a $30 pre-registry fee.
We raised it this year. It's $30 pre-register, $40 at the door.
There's a ton of events. That's not bad when you break it down.
You can play in seven events. If you played in the maximum amount of events, you could play in seven events for that.
And how much is it to register for one event?
$7.
And you could potentially get a 750-point army out of that, or a 1,000-point army out of that $7.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty good investment.
That's not a bad investment.
Nice little lottery.
It's a lottery ticket. Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, we had last year a guy who was dead set against playing Hordes. He won one of the crossover events. He just played War Machine, and he was like, oh, well, let's pick it up. Now he's playing Hordes full-time. I mean, not full-time, but he's got an army that he's committed to now. So let him get into it without any fuss, and now he's having fun with it. So
I got into Hordes.
Exactly. And I was gotten Hordes just because you got into Hordes.
Yeah, you got into Hordes because you had someone to play with.
There you go. But those sorts of things, people really appreciate those little extra touches, and you go the extra mile to give them that sort of thing. And I'm sure I speak on behalf of everybody when I say thanks for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I appreciate it. And like I said, all the players who have been here, they're the ones who make this happen. If I only had 10 people showing up every year, you know, we wouldn't be doing this. But it's all the players that make it happen. And it all goes out to them. All the thanks goes to them. So they're awesome.
Says the man who's been working for 4 months to get this going.
Yeah.
So this is the fifth year of War Machine Weekend. Carl, do you have any advice you would give to people who wanted to set something up on a similar scale, other than it's way more work than you think it's going to be?
Well, yeah. I mean, be realistic about it. I know the first weekend I went into it, I spent out of pocket a lot more money than I thought I was going to. So have some good sponsors lined up. And if you're going to do it, I mean, you can do it on any scale you want. I mean, there's people who organize tournaments at game stores all the time. This is something where you're trying to get Like, the idea is to get people from all over the area to come to your place to have fun. So go in with the right mindset. Know that it's going to be a lot of work. And know that you're not going to get very much sleep over the weekend. But go in and have fun. And if you want to do it, just do it. I mean, it sounds pretty cliche, but you're not going to get it done if you just sit there and go, oh, I don't know if I want to do this or that. I mean, go in and do it. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to find things that work. You're going to find things that don't. You're going to have players that have a blast. You're going to have players that fight. You're going to have players that only want to be there for one event. You'll have people who will be there and support you through the whole weekend. You're going to run the gamut of everything and just go in with it knowing that you're going to see everything and do everything and just go with it and have fun. Just go and do it. And once you have the mindset of I'm going to get this done and we're going to organize it and we're going to do it, whether it's a success or not, and we're going to learn from what went right and what went wrong, and then go from there, then everything will fall into place.
Well, I think Gen Con started in, what, Gygax's basement?
Yeah, something like
where it is now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, we started the first year in a hotel ballroom, but, you know, hopefully we get to the point where we have to move back to, you know, a hotel or someplace where it's outgrown this. And
yeah, but it's real convenient actually having the store to actually run it in.
It's nice because you don't have to pay the $700 to $1,000 for the ballroom over the course of 3 days and fight for dates against weddings and stuff. I mean, if you have a, you know, and it doesn't take anything like that. You could, if you wanted to run one, you could go to a local VFW hall and probably rent it out for a couple $100 for a weekend if you find the right place. So, I mean, there's those options available.
Where was it the Fear the Con was at?
I don't know where it was, but they had it for one day last year, and this year they're going to take two floors for 2 days.
Yeah, I can speak that a little bit because I've been hearing the announcements every week. It's I forget the exact name of it, but it was one of the community centers in St. Charles, and this year they're going to do a full 2 days.
And
same place, the same location. It was a good location, and they're also going to have the same, you know, all the vending people is there as well too. So it's.
And I'm planning on making it there this year.
Good.
You're
good.
Awesome.
You got some people?
We'll be glad to see
you. I think the Bear Swarm guys were talking about going, and I want to go.
Year,
and,
yeah.
And if there's another War Machine tournament there, I will drag some people kicking and screaming up with me.
We'll have to see what we can do about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the exact numbers, but I know that Dan mentioned it wasn't actually too expensive. And the place provided beer for free.
And they are going to again this year.
And they're going to again. So, I mean,
us by name.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really nice to have the store where you can do it. But if you need to find a place, if you look hard enough, you can find some nice places to run an event and not pay an arm and a leg.
It's just about being resourceful.
Absolutely.
Using what you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine Metagames doesn't have a liquor license, so that might be a problem.
Yeah,
I'd like to say we're working on that, but I can't. It'd be untruthful. But there is a really cool bar across the street.
Do they have room for tables?
No, they don't have room for hardly anybody, but they do have amazing hamburgers.
That's
fair enough.
Is there a place people can go to, some central location, say online, where they can get information about the weekend or somewhere they
can get
feedback?
We've been doing it like the Metagames website, which is www.mguinc.com. Stands for Metagames Unlimited Incorporated. If you go there, the forums will have information. We've got, you know, the different parts of the website, and it'll be up somewhere on there. And then through there, if you have any questions, you can get a hold of me. I go by Carl on that forums. I use my forum name on the, you know, anywhere from the Game St. Louis forums to the Privateer Boards, which is Clutch. That's my username there. Private message me. I'll be happy to answer any questions, advice, anything anybody needs help with. I will do what I can.
That's great.
Who all do you have as sponsors for this event?
Right now, I mean, Privateer Press helped us out, and also Metagames right now is our big sponsor. The owners have been hugely generous with the time and the space. Like, we basically shut down the store more or less for 3 days, and this is what we do. So they're awesome. Alan and Ryan, the owners of Metagames, awesome. Big thanks goes out to them.
Let you have the store until 4 a.m. last night.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's let us run roughshod over everything. And but he gives us a great space to play, and he gives us, you know, the time that we need. And it's midnight, get out type thing. It's you've got the place, just go. It's awesome. He's just top notch. So a big thanks to all those people.
I know when I came in today with Josh, we walked in and the owner was up in the ladder changing lights because it's a little bit dark on right. one side of the room. I mean, it was bright enough to play by, but the guy's up there on a step ladder changing all the fluorescent lights just to
with a bunch of random gamers ready to knock the ladder over by accident.
So he was just want to make sure he's a little compulsive about things like that, but he wants to make sure Alan is awesome because he wants to make sure the store is clean, the areas are well lit, that nobody has anybody to, you know, nobody will complain about, you know, anything. And that's just his little quirk, but it makes for a better gaming experience.
Absolutely.
It does.
The effort shows.
This is a very, very good looking store. It's very clean. Like you're saying, it's, again, you know, you've been in all kinds. Sometimes they're not as,
been
this
in the
is
dungeons.
Very clean. It's nice. Yeah. Dungeons. Exactly. So
this is a lovely shade of lime green.
I love the green room. It's great. It's just
say my only complaint is it's a little chilly. Freezing my bunions off here.
That's true.
And I'm already sick, as our listeners can probably tell.
So Carl, now you mentioned that you've been press ganging from pretty much day one.
I was one of the first 10 press gangers approved.
What's your number on the
91?
Wow, 91. Well, as a press ganger, so you've been playing for a while, but I guess you got into this game, you know, playing something. So what faction do you play?
I play Minoth.
I'm sorry.
The Protectorate.
We have a couple of racks out back. We can take care of them.
The funny thing is, when I started playing, I played Kotor. And then we went through a period.
I'm sorry, wait. Your original press ganger?
Yes.
And how did you pronounce that again?
Kotor.
Okay, I just want to make sure. Please continue.
You want me to say Kador?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. Okay. I want him to say Kador. pronounce it.
So I've been, day one, real heavy into them. And as I started playing more and more, the community was huge Kotor fans. And more people played them. I think it was their more straightforward army, so it wasn't. And ever since the game came out, since I got my copy of Prime that was sent to me because I pre-ordered the box sets at Gen Con, and I saw the Zealots in there, and I was like, oh, those things are cool. Those things are awesome.
Grenades.
And then right when Escalation came out, we had so many Kotor players that I'm like, I'm going to build this Zealot army. I'm going to play High Reclaimer. So High Reclaimer has been sort of my boy for a long time, but I've changed flavors a little bit. But the first time I ever got a chance to play them was right when the Monolith Bearer came out, and I was playing 30 Zealots, High Reclaimer, and a Redeemer, and some Deliverers, and had a guy that brought a all Man of War army, and I wiped him out to the man.
Wow!
I was going to say,
because you could actually hit with the rockets.
I would say if you actually had if you had such a strong Kotor presence here in town, I bet they didn't know what to think whenever you came in.
The other guy who was press ganging at the time, who's no longer a press ganger, gave me hell for weeks, and it was the start of infantry machine around here, I think, and it was like, oh, all these did that, and then it got to be the point where somebody would say, oh, those Zealots, they don't look that good. And I go, let's play.
Yeah, no kidding. Anyone that says that has not been on the receiving end of a good spanking from a Protectorate player.
You know, we're talking about the Protector here. Carl, I know I actually first met you at Rala at the tournament there, and talked to you a little bit about the Protectorate. You know, I'm a big Kreos fan. I mean, I don't think many Protectorate players aren't. And you said something that I find extremely interesting. You said that once you tried Epic Kreos, you never wanted to go back to the original version, which I find extremely intriguing, and I'd like to know more about that.
A couple years ago, when they announced the first Privateer Press Invitational, and they were like, they're going to be a hardcore tournament, I was like, okay, I want to play hardcore, but I don't want to bring something normal. I am somebody who loves fluff, and I like building theme armies, and even if it doesn't work real well, I'll stick with it and play it until I get sick of it. So I started playing. I've always liked the Knights Exemplar.
What makes Epic Kreos better?
I don't think he's better per se, but he is more fun to play, and he can come at, I mean, everybody knows that with regular Kreos, you're going to get knocked down. I mean, it's just a matter of how it is. Epicurios sort of does some of the same thing because his feat allows everybody to hit automatically. And the way I look at that is in a hardcore tournament, that because that's what I built the list for, is you can afford to take a few more models and do a lot more hits because you're not having to roll the hits. It's just like, I hit, here's the damage, here's the damage, here's the damage.
Well, it's not just the automatic hit, it's that you get to automatically hit an additional time.
Yes.
Which really sucks.
Yeah.
And that too. So, and even if you got all these weapon masters running around hitting you two, maybe three times, mm-hmm. it'll put a dent on whatever you've got.
Right. Okay.
And plus I like the knights. I like the theme, but it's just a fun list. So
what list did you actually bring to talk about today?
Okay, well, my basic list, and this is the one that I've been playing for a couple of years, and because I did it for hardcore and it's all painted, I like to bring it out because it's like, hey, I've actually got a fully painted army to put on the table. It's Epicurios, the Avatar, and the Revenger. Two Seneschals, two Racks, a full unit of Avengers, a minimum unit of Knights Errant, two units of Exemplar and Rupert. And that's exactly 750 points.
And like I said in a previous episode, Rupert is actually an Exemplar model. He converted and joined.
He has a sword.
He does.
And he's a Temple Flame Guard too. He's one of the few models that has a Temple Flame Guard and a knight.
Too bad he's not a unit. He could be an elite cadre.
He could. That would be awesome.
He's his own elite cadre.
Could be a cohort, I guess.
I've actually kind of gotten away from playing Knights Exemplar lately, primarily because I consider them slow. I know it's a speed 5, it's respectable, but I kind of like the 6 and up stuff. How do you deal with that with this army?
They are going to lag behind a little bit. Okay, two things with the army. One, you've got the Knights Errant to go up and be your meat shield to slow things up. I use them up front, and I typically put Sacrosanct on them. I remember my spells right. And I can either use them to hold off an enemy advance, put them in the middle, put them on the flank, however I need to do it. But that's the main reason I put the Revenger in there. A lot of people were telling me I needed to put a Devout instead of Revenger, but I need that Revenger for the Arc Node to get Sacrosanct. And plus, I actually use it to cast Cleansing Fire quite a bit.
Yeah, it's an expensive spell, but if your opponent's set up for it, it can be nasty.
And with so I put them up there as a roadblock. Anybody that is going to come in and take them out is going to have to lose some of the
their attacks next turn.
The attacks, some of the stuff they can move around, but they really can't do anything else. So it's going to hamper what they do to a point. And in a hardcore list, if I can take out the combat action or action of, anything, any model that goes around killing them, then it's fine. So they slow it down. I usually put Inviolable Resolve on the Avengers to up their armor by 2. They can't be moved around, and I go and use them as a big roadblock. So I run them up, and that lets Krios, who is slow, and the Knights, who are slow, get up in the fray and act as the ultimate second line to go in and mop up whatever you want. Plus, keeping the Knights around Krios a little more is a way to keep him alive, because if he takes damage early and they die around him, he heals. So they serve multiple purposes.
That's a nice little benefit on him. I don't see it used too often, but occasionally it can come in handy.
It doesn't. Yeah, it's one of those things that it's been a handful of games where it helped me win, because it may have healed 4 or 5 points of damage that would have killed him, but usually it's not quite an issue. If somebody's going in for the kill, if somebody gets, it's usually a one turn and done. If they don't get lucky, I've had people go in for the assassination and almost kill him and get frustrated because they didn't get the run, and they'll start killing things around him, which heals him, and then you sort of snicker and then come back and
you shouldn't snicker. That's not nice.
But it's a fun list, and with the Seneschals, like the Avatar is good to do crowd control. You can use them either as crowd control or a giant beat stick. The Seneschals obviously can control jacks, control bigger items that you just need or they can just go kill stuff too. The racks, I don't use so much as crowd control unless I know, like, I'm setting up second and I can throw them in the face of a Widowmaker unit that's all the way up front. But I'll usually put one rack up front and one closer to the deployment zone so I can get around it and pull from behind later in the game. And other than that, you just go up, make a hole, and you use your feet turn. I've used a number of games where they'll be trying to screen off their caster with infantry, and I'll be able to use the feet turn and the avatar and trample over their infantry to get swings on their caster when you don't have to worry about hitting. It's
did that to Pat one time.
It's demoralizing.
That's pretty much my experience playing against Dave. That's how I'd categorize it, is demoralizing.
The only thing that's more demoralizing is watch a warlock take multiple tough rolls when they should be dead. So,
yeah, you know, absolutely.
It's funny you mentioned that on tough rolls. I know yesterday I had Finn in my list, and that little guy. Oh, that's right. We're not PC.
We're explicit.
That little bastard made, I believe, 7 tough rolls
in a row.
He finally killed, but he didn't kill him that turn. He killed him the next turn.
And that
after he stood up and auto-plinked him for 1.
And that's why Karchev's an underused warcaster.
Yeah, but oh my gosh. I've never made so many tough rolls. But yeah, the tough rolls can be damnably frustrating.
Yeah, but whenever you get the auto hits, it helps out.
Definitely.
The high defense models, you get those high defense legion or circle or what have you, and you just go up and tag them, and usually a unit of knights, your seneschal, whatnot, will smoke anything with high defense on his feet turn. It's as long as you can get one person in, then you're probably got a good shot of winning.
Yeah, I think the biggest hurdle with knights in general is getting them to the opponent. If they get there,
the mobility of that second line, and you're going to be running probably at least the first 2 turns.
Sure.
But having that unit of Avengers to act as that, I mean, you've got the errants to go up there and try to deny what they can do early, the Avengers to act as the wall, and when they're sitting at armor 19 with inviolable resolve, that can't be moved, and then as soon as they take damage, now they're armor 21, they're taking a lot less damage at that point. Mm. I put a big wall of those guys up there, and then you just advance up behind them and try, and then at that point start making a hole and get your hole and go to town.
So no Vilmun in this list.
Honestly, if I could have had something as good as Rupert in there, I have to have Rupert in there for various reasons. You just have to play him. There's no ins and outs about it. But I could put Vilmun in there, but he's not a knight. So
I was about to say, we know Rupert is an exemplar and Vilmun's a paladin, so that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
No.
That would be silly.
They would not like each other.
You know, one thing, every time I think of Epic Kriess, the only thing I can think of as a Krix player is it Chasen?
No, you're thinking of Castigate.
Castigate, yes.
That hoses me every time I played Epic Kriess. Whether I'm playing Denegra, the Coven, what have you, if I can't arc where I need to, that's a shutdown. That shuts down most of my list in a lot of cases.
When you play, I've played against a few Coven players that just droop their head when they see him, because it's like you just know that that's the spell you're going to cast all the time, and it's going to stay there, and you're not going to get an arc node to do anything for you. And it's hard for them to deal with that, because instead of the Coven being able to sit back, they have to actually advance, and that's their weakness. So,
for benefit of our listeners, Castigate does prohibit
arcing
inside of Kriess's control radius. Now, because an arc node could sit outside and arc into it, it really only creates, on average, an 8-inch circle around Kriess that is immune to spells unless the Warcaster gets in there.
Right.
But you can pack a lot of knights at 8 inches.
Absolutely. And unlike a regular Kriess, he doesn't have any anti-upkeep things, does he?
He does. He has Chasen. And if it damages a target, removes upkeeps from him. He can hit his own guys, for example.
That's right. It says replacement for his weapon, right?
Yes.
His old weapon, I should say. And you know, even if a Coven player has a balanced list, like you should probably always take, you're still hosing the Coven's main thrust, and that's, you know, they're arcing their spells. Mm-hmm.
You're preventing the 3 Stygian Abysses coming in at you. And then you can devote the rest of your army to taking care of other things.
Although really, if you're playing Protectorate, not in this list, but usually you've got your caster warded anyway from a Devout, so you're not taking the Stygian
Abysses. Well, he doesn't have one in this list.
Which is what I'm saying.
And that's the thing, is like, that's one of the big, I when I first made the list, I argued with people and myself over, I've got to have a Devout, and I've got to have the Revenger. And having that, I find having that frontline defense of the errants with Sacrosanct on them was too important. Mm-hmm. And I needed that to slow up most armies somehow.
Sure.
And I dropped the Devout and just left the Revenger in there.
Well, I think it's also a good thing to branch out other than just, you know, from just doing all the auto includes that people will do. Like I know as a Signar player, I'm guilty of the, you know, a journeyman Warcaster is always included in a list almost every time I play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a few things that are like that, but so, you know, it's good to try something new. And like you said, from what you said, this list, you've got a very well-defined tactic of how you're going to play it. And every piece has an important role, and that's what you've got to have. And that's what the game's all about, you know, finding new, interesting ways to obliterate and demoralize your opponents. Now, right, Dave?
Pretty much.
And it's fun, but I've in actual competitive tournament play, I'm probably 60-70% wins. I mean, I've won more than I've lost, but I still lose. And I haven't won any hardcore event with it, but it's still fun. It does its fair share of damage.
When you do lose, how do you typically end up losing?
Yes, how do we beat you with this?
How do you? Epic Vlad will get in there.
let me guess. He feeds in a Dracogon and gets thrown at you, right?
I've seen that before, but I've seen a few different things. I've never had to face that.
Mm-hmm.
I played against a couple Epic Vlad players that use it a little late, but weren't able to get the swing. They used their feet to clear out the army, but that was probably more before it became in vogue to try to do the quick caster kill with it. They did it more to, I'm going to eliminate everything around you and then go for you. If that first defensive wall between the Vengers and the Exemplar, or the, excuse me, the Errants, if that gets broken through too quick, it can get tough. Stuff like, I mean, the Death Jack is a really tough one to, because they advance deploy, and if you can't go up and control it with one of your own things and it gets into your stuff too much, it hurts.
Do you have to use Avengers for that usually?
I'd rather try to use a Seneschal to go in and tie it up or knock it down and control it somehow. But you try to control the things that, you know, I have the hardest problem with and try to stick to the game plan. That's the big thing, is if somebody starts making me play the way they want to as opposed to how I feel I should play it, then I start falling apart. But that's probably common for any list.
I was about to ask, if you're forced to feed early, for example, to take out a Death Jack, how do you adapt to that?
If you are forced to feed early, you try to still do the same thing you're going to do, but then you're going to have to maybe pull those things like your Seneschals, your stuff that has a higher mat. Mm-hmm. I mean, Krios himself. To make that spearhead, and they're going to have to go get the job done themselves instead of having the Knights Exemplar coming in on a charge, you know, with March on them, hitting you with three attacks and doing it themselves. You pretty much have to use Krios to go get the job done. And he can do it, especially, you know, medium or large size base with thrust, which, you know, is armor piercing.
I see him kill Kray with one blow on the feet.
Yep.
Yeah, I think, I mean, whenever I play Epic Krios, and I'm not as big of an Epic Krios fan. I think I don't have myself in the mindset to play him correctly yet. But I really want to get him up there, but he feels like it takes him forever to get there. And that might be because I also like playing faster units, and they leave him behind.
Yeah.
Even some of your slower casters, I mean, Fiora, she's a six, I'm guessing.
She's a six.
But she's really faster than that, though, with some of her
spells. Regular Fiora is.
Right. Or you can, you know, Fire Step or use or whatever.
And Epic Fiora can Fire Step.
He is horribly slow. Any caster that's a five, you'll feel it. Any five speed is, you have to find ways to weasel around to get that extra inches.
Yeah.
You know, cast your spell, you know, charge something across the board, fail the charge just to get those few extra inches. So I've done that more than once.
Sure.
Just looking at the jacks on the list, now that the character jacks are starting to come out, do you see their place in this, swapping out for the Avatar and the Revenger?
No. The Avatar is too efficient for what it does. It's free focus that Krios needs himself. He needs that to either upkeep all the spells, because like all his good spells are upkeepable. He needs that to, like, sometimes you need that for the cleansing fire to open those holes, or, you know, if you can get a good hit on something with cleansing, you know, a caster that has, you know, and if you catch it on fire, then that's just a bonus. But I find that he needs that, or he needs the armor. So I, even though I like Fire Salvation, I think I like it better with regular Krios than I like it with Epic Krios.
Speaking of upkeep spells, and this is true of regular Krios in general, does that concern you at all now with the prevalence of models that remove upkeep spells and do damage to you?
That and it, and also models like, I believe, Saren that copies them.
Yeah,
yeah, that, true? That stinks.
You know, Gorsha has been doing that since day.
Yeah, Saren is probably my number one concern, because not only can she do, you know, take all your cool upkeep spells, but she also, you know, her feat totally neuters a list that is based on making melee attacks.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that will hurt worse than anything. If you eliminate what I can do to you, then they can eliminate, you know, my timing of my feet turn. They can do a lot. And it's probably the list that I have the hardest time dealing with.
So actually, if I was playing Legion against this list, I'd take Saren.
You would do well.
I think, well, I don't know. I'd get the first pounce, but the next turn, typically I'd have the feet up. If I could get the Krios the following turn, I'd be fine. Otherwise, my high defense, low armor bites me in the butt.
It's definitely a game of chicken with that. It's like you got to take that hit, and then after, you can't pop your feet until after she pops hers. So a smart Saren player will wait till the very last second, because either if I've got a charge lane and they haven't done it, then obviously it's going. But
with the speed differential.
Yeah, it's hard to do that. So a good Saren player will know how to stall it out to their advantage. And that's tough to deal with. But Saren, I mean, other high defense models I don't have so much problem with.
Any other Legion Warcaster,
Ryas would, you know, being able to jump around, if you don't space your stuff out right, can be a problem.
Yeah, you know, with new Warchief, I mean, we've seen Warchief plus Massacre plus Ryas' feet do some very mean things. With all that infantry, it could potentially be a problem. That's actually one thing I notice, is there's no Devout to, for example, Defensive Strike and Lower Mat at a critical moment. So if something can get back there quickly. So, and, you know, Warmonger comes up there with Power Plus Strength 24 because it's killed 10 models. We've seen that happen.
Yeah.
That's going to hurt a Warcaster.
He's what, 14 defense?
He's 14 defense, 16 armor. Is that correct? I think he was 15 and went up.
Yes, that sounds right. I don't have my stats in front of me, but that sounds right.
So Warchief is 8, minus 2. You just still need an 8 to hit.
Mm-hmm.
But you can roll an 8 pretty easily sometimes.
And if you get two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it was a larger game, like we like to play 999-point games around here from time to time, then it gets really gross what you can do. Then I can put in all the extra stuff. But in a normal, you know, nobody does that on a regular basis. So yeah, I skip that, and I skip the Devout, which I miss a lot. But if you're playing a very offensive minded game, which I think you have to stay in that mindset, you just got to keep taking it to them and not play defensively. You just got to go.
I'm looking at your list, and it just occurred to me, I consider them such an auto-include, I never even look for them anymore. You don't have a choir.
No.
Well, the Avatar's not. Well, the Avatar would benefit, but really he's pretty good by himself, you know.
The choir, there's no points for. You know, that's one of the weird things is people get on to me is, I usually play pretty aggressive with whatever I play. I don't play the choir all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're good, and I should. But with this, I can
see where you'd have to drop an exemplar or seneschal if you
wanted
to put one in.
And with the Avatar is such a hoss anyway. I mean, his mat is relatively high for a jack. His strength is ridiculously high. The plus 2 to hit damage now, and then, you know, he's already got defense against spells. It's going to take a pretty beefy range attack to keep him from getting across the field. And if I get my Revenger out there, and if I get the turn to get all my spells cast, and if there's nothing that's going to mess with my upkeeps, then the choir at that point are just sort of extra baggage.
Yeah.
I mean, they're nice to have.
They're points of health for Krios waiting to happen.
Yes.
Well, you're talking about trampling the Avatar up to the enemy caster.
Yes.
It sounds like you play the Avatar pretty far forward in a lot of cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if you're doing crowd control.
Yeah, yeah. If I, the Avatar, like I said, will either go up and take out hard targets as quick as I can, like a death jack. He'll get up there and just I'll sick him on him at times, or I will use them to go wade into troops and use Gaze of Minoth to pull them in just to keep them. And that helps open those holes to the to the back lines.
Sometimes even if that gets the Avatar killed, it's caused the havoc you need to win.
Yeah, anything
that kills the enemy Warcaster is worth it.
Sure.
Yeah, and a lot of times it'll take them a little while, but depending on what you're wading into, you can pull everything in and then, you know, on your feet turn, trample out of that is also fun to do too.
That's nice.
But yeah, Avatar, I think, is an auto-include with Epic Krios, just because, like I said, I think he needs his focus too much, and the Avatar, you know, 2 to 4 every turn. Mm-hmm. So
now, I don't actually, whenever I play Krios, Epic Krios, I don't use the Avatar as much. I've actually found some nice use for the Guardian, because it can trample and has the reach.
Yeah.
It's a little bit slower, and it doesn't generate its own focus. But it's an arc node too, which is a double-edged sword because it means it's easier to wreck. But I think that the Guardian also is a decent choice with Epic Krios if you're not already taking the Avatar.
The only thing, I mean, the Guardian has the issue with, you know, possibly getting disabled too soon.
Absolutely.
And
you need a choir.
And you really, with the Guardian, I think you want to roll to hit. So on that feet turn, if you're hitting something, you want to roll to try to get that critical pitch a lot of times.
I think it depends on what you're attacking.
Yeah, it does. But like the Avatar too, the other option is you can cast Inviolable Resolve on the Avatar. And now you're sitting at an armor 23.
That can't get moved,
and it just stays there. And at that point, infantry have a hard time getting rid of it, and it just sticks around and keeps pulling them in.
One thing I wanted to ask you: you touched on a little bit trampling for the auto hits during his feet, and I haven't seen this too much, but you know, power attacks are all melee attacks. Have you guys seen the feet used just to get a good slam off or a throw off or something like that?
I'll use it. I'll use the feet turn for seneschals to clear out lanes or just to control jacks all the time.
Because I was thinking of slamming auto with the jack, but yes,
Warbeast too, like high defense Warbeast, just to knock them out of the way or slam them into other troops. I'll do that all the time.
I think you don't see that as much because typically if you're slamming or throwing something, it's either to get it out of the way, which case, like he said, he has a seneschals for, or to knock something specifically down so you auto hit it.
I mean,
but
you
your feet does that anyway.
Sure, sure.
And I mean, there's no range element he's got to knock down. I mean,
right.
Blessed crossbows, but they're probably not going to kill a caster.
Yeah, the best thing you do with those is try to pick out important people if you can get early shots on them. Like if they've got an Ionian Holt that's sitting across the field and you take a couple pot shots at them, and then maybe go them into killing one of them so you can sacrosanct Holt so he can't, you know, attack anything for a turn. But at that point, then they're just going to go invisible the next turn, and it's not as big an issue, but at least it keeps them from getting real gross or, you know, trying to take out a unit leader here and there. It's sort of hit and miss.
You also have plenty of blessed weapons in the list, which is a pain for, say, a Krix player like me.
And so the immunity to corrosion becomes a little elite cadre.
Right.
No corrosion, no fire. I had a really neat game against a Epic Fiora player.
Oh, I bet he was angry.
Who did the whole, I'm going to put fire on all my own guys on a unit. He took a unit of Zealots with Greater Destiny, caught almost the entire unit on fire, and then tried to transfer the fire. And I was like, you can't do that. And he was like, really? And he had to put all the fire back on his own things, and it really hurt.
Oops.
But yeah, that's something that a lot of people forget too. And you know, there's times where there's another guy here locally that has been playing around with him. He'll even forget it at times, but it becomes real important. And it's amazingly how many times that gets, you know, something will happen and it's just like, you can't catch them on fire, you can't corrode them. Yeah. It's pretty handy. The Avengers, unfortunately, still can get caught on fire.
Oh, it has to be Knight's Exemplar.
Yeah, it's Knight's Exemplar to get that because it's part of the elite cadre,
right?
So,
okay. Same thing with the Bastions. Bastions aren't Knights either, are they?
Correct. Same with Gravis and Rovan's Honor Guard.
Right.
The only elite cadre are the Knight's Exemplar and the Knight's Exemplar Errant.
Yeah.
Well, Exemplar Errant because they say Knight's Exemplar unit. However, all of those models that we just mentioned do feed Gravis because he feeds on Exemplar models, not Knight's Exemplar.
And the Piper too, right?
Well, he doesn't because it's only in his heart. His card doesn't say it.
Ah.
I can't wait to get my Black 13th. That'll be elite cadre.
Yeah. Oh, God. All right.
What were they thinking of that?
I don't know. I jumped the gun, apparently, on what would you do against this army. But, Pat, you have the one thing that I hate fielding Epic Chaos against, and that is the big, giant, ranged army. I've played Epic Chaos against Epic Kane before, and I didn't like it.
Hmm.
What do you do against this list playing Signar?
One of the things that you mentioned about this army was that it's not quite as it's got some speed issues, so it's not as it's the fastest thing. So for me, that really kind of tells me something with a higher mobility is something I would want to look for. So I'm thinking definitely I'm going to have my Storm Lances in there just to counteract your Vengers for one thing, sort of match that high armor on high armor. I've been playing a lot of Kray, and I've been talking a lot about Kray lately because I like him. But the two things he's got is he's got mobility, and he's got the support for the ranged attacks. Yeah. And I think that that's going to be pretty important against this list. So I'm thinking,
Sentinel would be pretty bad.
Kray with a Hunter and a Sentinel.
Yeah.
The Hunter's going to be great against the Avatar. I mean, it's only one shot around, but it's
the
that armor piercing
Sentinel
makes a
taking
deal.
Out mass knights will hurt really bad if
it
you
will.
Can position them right.
And I have had some good luck with the Thunderhead on Kray.
Yep.
And I think a Thunderhead against this list, I think you've got enough stuff that, I can hit it. And the armor isn't ridiculously high that, a POW 14, or I'm sorry, POW 12's on the purge round. I'm still going to have a shot at killing, especially your one-hit models.
The pulse stuff, if you pulse at the right time, will really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, I guess, if I remember right, you can if you have strange ways and get the pulse while you're still engaged now. Is that right?
Or Ion and Holt.
Yeah,
they make it
either
a magic
one.
Attack.
Yeah, so you can still go engage and then try to bait them in and make it really nasty. I think when it comes to Signar, what I probably fear the most, and it was two things that I've played against, and I had a really hard time. I played TB Turtle, sucks.
Oh, absolutely.
That is just rancid.
That was my other option. I don't play Haley a whole lot anymore, but I was thinking, especially in this list, you're slow to begin with, and especially on that feet turn where you're gonna mow through me. I'm thinking a well-placed temporal barrier is going to help me a lot in the fact that, at least you can't charge me.
Yeah.
And you can only walk.
That stinks. And I played against a guy who played a Striker Turtle army. And on his feet turn, you just can't kill anything. And then he was playing with a couple Lancers where all he was doing was just casting Earthquake twice a game.
Again, on that feet turn, your stuff can't come up and kill me if I've knocked you down right before you do it. So, I mean, what that could do is, it'll screw up the timing of your feet possibly. So that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
That would be a pretty good strategy as well. So,
yeah, that's the problem. Is the list has to get to you. Anything that stops it from getting to you makes it very difficult.
Slowing it down, or like even the TB Turtle and Haley, where you can unload with a massive amount of range attacks on it, will get real painful.
Mm-hmm.
Long gunners stink, but once you get into them, they're gone.
Yeah,
and that's what the cleansing fire is for. Oftentimes, I'll if I see something like that, I'll try to work that Revenger up to a point where I can lob some cleansing fire shots. Hopefully, take out a chunk of that.
I've moved away from my long gunners for a while, and I don't know. I may have to try to get back into them a little bit, but what it is, I moved from long gunners to trenchers, and I love my trenchers now. So they're nice even against this one, they might be good in the fact that they're up there and they can take some shots at first. But the other thing they'll be a speed bump.
Yeah,
especially on that feet turn. If they survive to the feet turn, they're gonna die. But you're gonna have to kill them, and that's gonna potentially keep something from behind them.
Yeah.
Other than the trample, obviously.
If I see trenchers out there, and if I can somehow charge them early game with the errants, try to whittle them out that way, I do that. But it's usually the Signar players are a little smarter than just leave them out there as sitting ducks. So,
yeah, I usually don't deploy them. I almost never deploy them fully.
Yeah.
I put them out maybe about halfway or so, because I learned, you put them out, you hang them out in the breeze, they're just going to die.
Yeah.
And it's pretty easy. Unless you go first. If you go first, maybe it's different. But yeah, if you definitely don't go first, those trenchers are never fully deployed.
So, Josh,
yeah.
Other than the fact that you can't corrode the knights, what are you going to do against them?
I've had a little bit of luck using Terminus against Epic Krios. It's a careful game you have to play. You need to keep a lot of focus on Forza armor because you got a lot of hard hitters. But Terminus can advance slowly, sort of almost as slowly as Krios, really, throwing a model here and there if he needs to knock it down. And if you can amass a bunch of pirates or bottles or whatever in front of him to keep you from charging him, you can often stave off some of those killing blows for a while. Actually, one thing I wanted to mention, and this is especially me as a Krix player, I don't know if the other factions notice this as much. I'm sure they do. Smart Protectorate player, when using the Seneschals, will present you a choice. You kill the Seneschal now and then kill another friendly model nearby, or do the opposite, you know, to keep the Seneschal alive. And I found that it's caused me fits a lot of times as a Krix player, at least, you know, forcing me to kill the Seneschal first and then keeping him alive by killing something else that I need to die. Yeah. So if you can set up that sort of thing, then you'll have a Seneschal right there, possibly next to Terminus or whoever, that can really deliver a couple hits. Can't even remember what that ability is called.
Restoration,
yeah.
Most people will, that have played Protectorate any, they will work around that. They will do all they can to hit them last. Mm-hmm. They know that.
Yeah.
One thing that I've done a couple times, especially if I know I'm playing against somebody who knows how to play against Protectorate, I will use the Seneschals together, mm-hmm, and try to get them up, two of them, you know,
well,
near each other.
They can't restore each other, though, I don't think. I don't think the restorations will help each other.
But it seems, I know they can't restore each other, but mm-hmm, with having two of them up there spaced apart, it always seems to throws them a curveball a little bit.
I can see that, sure.
But, you know, it's like, which one are you gonna kill? And usually they'll take out one. If they're smart, they can take out both of them. And, putting them near one another and also the knights near them too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a matter of presenting enough targets.
Right.
So if you really want to get something with it, you usually can, but mm-hmm, it's tough sometimes.
Yeah.
What about hordes?
Turn my warlock away and walk off the back of my deployment zone.
Fair enough. I would like to see a troll or Scorn versus this game because it would just be everybody running towards the middle to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be a meat grinder.
Horluck would scare me with his disillusion. Would you would have to start choosing, you know, pretty soon what you're going to recast because, you know, you need your focus for armor. And if you keep doing that, and it just makes it that much harder to figure out what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Even Vexation, or no, Accursed, the one that chooses you to, you know, choose something to sack, that could really hose a particular model who might be.
Vexation, I think, is also the one that makes you go first or last. And if they if they are smart about that, they can take your roadblock unit and use it against you.
Yep.
Say that they're going to go last, and that means you're not able to maneuver or do what you want to do with them. So
if you have those errands up front, like you were saying, that might really screw you.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Pat, what would you do with hordes?
Well, that's a good question. I think that I would probably take... wait a minute. I don't play hordes.
Okay. Dave?
I already talked about the Legion.
Done.
Next issue!
Okay, Mr. McNeil.
What about Kador? What have you seen facing Kador with List?
I've had pretty good luck. The one thing that really stinks, the one caster that I have a harder time with is the Old Witch.
Oh, I can see that.
Just the first turn feat. If they go first, the first turn feat to basically freeze a good chunk of my army in place, I'll oftentimes take that hit on the Vengers. Ups their armor. I mean, you're going to take a little bit of damage, but with you know, the right spell placement, you know, you cast Vile Resolve on them, then go, makes it a little more survivable, gets them up there, but it freezes, you know, your knights are going to stay in place for the most part. If I see her, I will try to spread out my army quite a bit more and work it a little different, but that stinks a lot. I've had pretty decent luck. I mean, Epic Vlad is still...
At least you can hit him.
You can hit him, and if you... But if they... It's almost the same type of army. You're whittling away to find that hole, and once you've got that hole with Epic Vlad, you know, you use your feet and you send one or two things in, and it will kill Krios if you're not careful.
Sure.
But I've had pretty good luck against Kador, but the old reliable Sorsha is going to be a pain. Mm-hmm.
Either Butcher with Retaliation is going
to
be mean.
Yeah. You just have to pick your time. Yeah, Kador is very... Very similar. I find it a little. I think that's why I find it easier to play is because it's a lot of times the same type of game you're playing.
Kador players probably used to playing against something different.
Yeah.
They don't see someone bring their same style of army to the tables often.
And it really, they're the same type of thing. I mean, Minoth and Cawdor are very similar, but where one is oftentimes straight melee, Protector is a lot more assault oriented, where it's melee and range in various forms, but very close to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, probably the only other thing is the possible possible addition to Gravis.
Sure.
I mean, that list I've been using for a long time. The only thing I've been playing around with, and I don't like dropping some of the stuff, but adding Gravis and, you know, dropping a couple Vengers in the racks just to fit him in, and it's, again, it's an exact 750 points. He is really good once the knights start dying around him.
Sure.
And it just, the whole army feeds him, and he can also become that big, you know, roadblock in the middle of the table that people have a hard time dealing with. And he also, you know, makes your Vengers a little better. With him, I try to use the Vengers, I think, a little more offensively than like a roadblock. I'd probably put Viable Resolve on him, possibly.
I could see him with a bunch of Grim Resolve tokens on Epic Kreos' feet turn, wiping out everything within reach. That's he could make, what, 7 attacks on that turn, auto-hitting Weapon Master?
Yeah. But he's
impact attacks.
Yeah, he's still good.
All right, well, I guess that's that does it for this week. Carl, we'd like to thank you for coming on the show and talking to us, especially considering how busy you are here.
I appreciate you guys coming in and traveling all the way down to Springfield to come play.
Oh, it's worth it.
Absolutely.
Yes. So I guess that's it for this week.
I think so.
It is. All right. Well, see everybody later.
See you.
Talk to you later.
Iron Agenda is copyright 2008 by its hosts and released under the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. Opening and closing music provided courtesy of Joshua Salter.